is Nicole Whitney, News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained.
You're now tuned in to Nicole Whitney's News for the Soul highlights, life-changing spotlights she has shared with leading teachers in the human consciousness field since 1997. Go now to newsforthesoul.com to hear the full shows totally free. That's newsforthesoul.com.
Yay, we are live April 11th, 2017. It is 10 a.m. Pacific, 11 Mountain Time, I do believe, and that's the time we had pegged away for a very special hour on News for the Soul, especially in times that we are in right now. We've talked to him many times over the years, and this, I believe, is going to be one of the most important chats because of what's going on in our world today. Greg Braden, New York Times best-selling author, is internationally known as a pioneer in bridging science and spirit, which is one of the favorite places we like to hang out. Following a successful career as a computer geologist in the 1970s, he worked as a senior liaison with the U.S. Air Force Space Command during the Cold War years in the 80s. In the 90s, he became started exploring the spirituality side as well, and the two come together in a very most interesting way. He explored high mountain villages, remote monasteries, and forgotten texts, and started connecting the dots, and that's where it gets really exciting. Today we're going to talk about his latest book as well, Resilience of the Heart. I understand it's the revised edition of The Turning Point, so we're going to find out all about that and find out what I'm most excited about, checking in and tuning in with Greg's exciting perspective, conscious perspective on what the heck is going on in our world of extremes right now. Greg Braden, welcome back to News for the Soul.
Hey, Nicole, it's so good to hear your voice. I'm absolutely thrilled to be with you today and thrilled to be with our audience. Thank you for inviting me back. We've done this a number of times, and when I saw the list came into my office of my media interviews that I was going to have this week, I saw your name. Big smile on my face because we always have a really great program, and I appreciate you very much. Thank you.
Oh, right back at you. We are very much appreciating the piece that you bring to the big picture, and holy moly, I don't even know where to start today. It's been a few years since we've talked, but
can I get us started today?
Yes.
I'm going to just share with our listeners, I had a really interesting interview recently, another radio station, and the first thing the interviewer said to me, he didn't say, welcome to the show, how are you, anything like that. He said, Greg, why can't you stick with one topic like everybody else? He said, you are all over the map. He said, are you talking about science, spirituality, about DNA, about ancient history, about earth magnetics, about climate change? He goes, what are you talking about? And I said, you know, every one of those things that you've just mentioned is a facet of the human experience. And in a very real sense, I said, I am talking about one thing, one topic. It just happens to be a really big topic, and it's about us and our relationship to ourselves and to the world and to the past and one another and to the future. And then he said, well, let's take a station break. And then we came back and did the rest of the interview. So my work, it does touch on many facets of our experience because we don't live in a vacuum. That's the world that we live in. And that's one of the reasons I love working with you, Nicole, because you are doing such a beautiful job of taking a message that for some people is a new way and a very different way of thinking and sharing this in a responsible way across the airwaves. And I appreciate that. I just appreciate it tremendously.
Well, we really value your work and your piece, and I'm extremely interested to get your overall perspective. That's where I'd like to start is, the world's very different than it was when we last talked. We were kind of on this exciting ascension of connection, and you were showing videos of tumors disappearing in 60 seconds. We're all very happy and excited and woo. And we thought we'd be in a different place by now. It's got this overall view of things kind of going off the rails in the mainstream, and I thought we were further ahead, evolved consciously, and perspective on where we are in the world within the spirit and consciousness connections. How would you sum it up in that view?
Yeah, I was just reading a history summary of the last 200 years of our experience, and what many historians now are suggesting, they embrace that the 20th century, they're saying, was a century of what they're calling a century of discovery. Okay, so the big discoveries of physics, classical physics, quantum physics, subatomic particles, DNA, The Dead Sea Scrolls, the Nag Hammadi Library, the oldest records of the New Testament, the Nag Hammadi, and space exploration. It was a century of exploration, and it revealed many things to us. And the 21st century, they say, where we are right now, is we are on a very steep learning curve of discovering where those discoveries fit in our lives. How do we apply what we now know to be true in our everyday lives? And I think the world is reflecting that. Right now, Nicole, I trust in the process. The world is a different place than I expected that we would be in, on the one hand. And on the other hand, the indigenous people that I've talked to and worked with, many of the ancient texts, they say within the first 25 years of this new century, they said we won't even recognize our lives and our world anymore. And I think, we're seeing that happen. So we're learning about ourselves and our relationship to the world based upon new discoveries. And this is what I'm writing about. The new book, the newest book that is on the market right now that you have access to is called Resilience from the Heart. There's actually another book that will be released October of this year called, the title is Human by Design. And both of these books are based upon peer-reviewed science. So it's rock-solid science, not necessarily my opinion or my perspective or my hypotheses or my theories, but this is the new science, Nicole, that is changing the way we think about ourselves and our relationship to the world on the one hand. And on the other hand, there is not only a reluctance, but there is a resistance to sharing a lot of this new information in the mainstream because it overturns 150 years of scientific thinking and the story that we tell ourselves. We are steeped in this scientific story that's based upon separation, scarcity, competition, and conflict. And the new discoveries are telling us that we live in a world of cooperation. Nature is based upon cooperation, not competition, and that we are deeply connected to ourselves and one another. And the science is showing us just how deep these connections go. So that is the theme for both of the new books, and the one that you just mentioned, Resilience from the Heart, is just that. It is about the new discoveries of specialized cells in the human heart that allow us a direct access to our bodies in ways that we've never thought possible in the past. We thought only mystics and yogis and special adepts could do something like this, and now it's becoming available to everyday people. So that's a long answer to a short question. I trust in the process in the world, and what I think we're seeing is an unfolding of understandings of what is sustainable or what's not, what works, what doesn't. And what we're finding is a lot of the way we've been taught to think is no longer sustainable. And so we're the generation that's bridging these new discoveries and learning to apply them in our world. And I can't think of a more exciting time to be alive. I'm sure many of your other speakers are probably saying something very similar. So again, that's a long answer to a short question, and I'll follow your lead, and we can go anywhere we want to go from there.
It is a very exciting time for sure. And I think you nailed it right in the first half of your first sentence in response was that, before we were learning about these things, now it's essentially, I'm paraphrasing obviously, but basically we have to start doing what we've learned.
Yeah.
Being it.
Well, that's the thing. What's happening is in the mid-1800s, when I began talking about the discoveries of Charles Darwin and, many of the physicists that were making discoveries in the late 1800s, people say to me, Greg, we're in the 21st century. What difference could those things possibly make? And it's a really good question, and the answer surprises a lot of people. Yes, we are in the early 21st century, a sophisticated, highly technological world, and the society that we find ourselves in and the way we have been conditioned to think about jobs, about industry, about our relationship to the earth, about personal relationships, the economy, corporations, all of those things, those ideas, those foundations were created in the mid to late 1800s. So we are steeped in a story based upon the science of the late 1800s, and now the new science is overturning many of those beliefs. So knowing that we live in a world of cooperation, for example, rather than competition, that nature is actually based in cooperation, our economic systems were based upon competition and conflict based on the science of the 1800s. And that's why the economies of the world are in chaos right now. We're seeing the Brexit in the Middle East. We're seeing the European Union face a possible breakdown. We're looking at the kind of debt. Here's a question, Nicole. This is fascinating. We've all seen nations in debt in the past, and it's common for another nation or a group of nations to bail them out. What happens when the debt of the entire planet is greater than what the entire planet is producing? When the GDP of the entire planet is less than the debt that we've accumulated, who bails out an entire planet? And I don't know the answer to that. We're about to find out, because that's where we are right now. The industrialized nations have accrued so much debt that can never be paid back. That affects everything from the way that we save for retirement, the way we save for our kids' education, our health care, all of those things. So they're breaking down because they are based on principles that are simply not true. We don't live in a world of competition and conflict. We see those things. I mean, we have to be real, though we definitely witness competition and conflict in the world. And what the scientists now are telling us is the more of that competition and conflict that we see in the world, the further we have strayed from the natural laws and the more difficult it is for us to find our balance. So for me personally, I'm a scientist. I was trained as an earth scientist, a geologist. And I know some of your other guests and dear friends of mine, Dr. Bruce Lipton, for example, and Dr. Joe Dispenza. We all look to nature for the model of helping us to understand our relationship to ourselves and to the world, and how to build a healthy family and a healthy community and healthy societies. So if we look to nature, nature is showing us a very different model than what we have in place right now, and we're seeing, I think, the world is going through the throes of the changes to try to get back to more of those natural states of balance. And that's what the book Resilience from the Heart is all about, because one of the discoveries, and we mentioned this briefly in another interview, one of the discoveries that has just rocked the world of the medical world, the world of biology, is the discovery of 40,000 specialized cells in the human heart that were simply not recognized in the capacity that they are right now. They are called sensory neurites. And that's a technical term. They're essentially brain-like cells, but they're not in the brain. They're in the heart. So these are the kind of cells you would expect to see in the cranial brain, but they're in the heart. And the reason this is important is because these cells think independently of the cells in our brain. They feel independently of the cells in our brain, and they remember independently of the cells in our brain. So every experience we've had in our lives, essentially it's recorded in two places. It's recorded in our brain and the way our brain interprets it, and we know about that. It's recorded in our heart and the way our heart interprets these experiences through these 40,000 cells that have created a neural network that is literally, it's called the little brain in the heart, is the term that's being used now. So now that we know these cells exist, as we're learning to access them, they open the door to extraordinary abilities that I personally believe are actually ordinary abilities that we've either lost or forgotten. And when we can embrace these abilities in our lives, it helps us to embrace change in the world in a healthy way. So if we ever needed a time, or if we never needed some help in embracing the tremendous change happening in the world, now I think is the time to do that, because we are undergoing such a radical shift in the world that we've known in the past. So this is the theme. The new book, in the very first chapter, you asked about the two books. There was a book that was released, I think it was 2015 or 2014. It was called The Turning Point, and it was a good book. It put many of the personal applications and the direct experience and the exercises that help people in their lives, they were in the back of the book. And one of the things that I've learned, Nicole, I'm a student of learning to listen. I'm still learning, and I work very diligently in listening to my audience and to our global audience. And what people all over the world said, they said, we want to get to that stuff faster. We want to get to the stuff that's going to help us in our everyday lives, direct experience, techniques, tools, applications. So I moved all of that to the front, and I added the new material and the new discoveries that simply were not available when I had written the book 2 years previous. So it's new material covering these 40,000 neurites, how we access them, and what it means in a changing world. And that is what sets those two books apart from one another. Does that make sense if I say it that way?
It's so interesting. I am decades ago, I interviewed Joseph Chilton Pierce, you know, cracking the cosmic egg, and he was saying all along, you know, for years and years and years, that the real brain power was in the heart, and we've heard so many people refer to that. So when was this recent study you're referring to, when was that published?
Well, first, I've had the honor of knowing, touring, and presenting with Joseph Chilton Pierce, and he mm-hmm. was working very closely with the Institute of Heart Math,
yes.
H-E-A-R-T, capital M-A-T-H, all one word. This is the pioneering research organization based in Northern California that explores the power of the human heart in unconventional ways, in ways that typically aren't done in the universities and in the medical schools, but based in science, in peer-reviewed science. So I had the opportunity of touring with Joseph Chilton Pierce during the years when a lot of this information is being developed. The discovery was made in 1991. It wasn't published until 1994. And even though, this is fascinating for me, even though it was published in 94 and it is now documented, it's peer-reviewed science is documented, it is still not being taught in major medical institutions. And I just came last weekend. I just came from a large conference, and it's very common for us to have medical professionals and healing professionals and scientists and engineers in the audience, along with, you know, with everyone else, the spiritual seekers. They all come together because this material touches on so many different facets of our experience. And I had medical students in the audience, and they were saying, why don't we know about this? Why isn't this being taught in medical school? And I said, you know, I can't answer that question. But you're here now, and now you know about it. So, but it changes. It changes everything. When we talk about this little brain in the heart, and people say, well, you know, is it really a brain? It is it's a collection of cells that are concentrated into a network, a neural network, smaller but very similar to what we see in the brain. And we've learned to use the brain independently. We know that. Now we know that we can use the heart independently. And we also know now that we can harmonize, we can literally tune the heart and the brain together. So two separate organs, but it is one very potent neural network to give us access to extraordinary experiences like deep intuition on demand when we choose to have it rather than spontaneously, you know, when it just happens to occur. It gives us direct access to the subconscious. It's a hotline to the subconscious without hypnosis and without, you know, listening to a special tape. You can do all those things, but sometimes they're not available. So direct access to the subconscious, and this is important for people who are using affirmations, because an affirmation of healing or health or relationship or career success or self-esteem or abundance or any of those kinds of things, they can only be effective when we are communicating with the subconscious. And if we simply say these things in our mind, but we're not accessing our subconscious, they may not have the effect that we hope that they have. So this harmonizing of the heart and the brain is a hotline into the subconscious to make those kinds of things more effective. Harmonizing the heart and the brain is a trigger for a extra powerful, super immune response. And I can speak for my colleagues, my dear spiritual brothers and friends that I've toured with, such as Bruce Lipton and Joe Dispenza. We use these tools, or we couldn't tour the world with the kinds of schedules we have if we didn't have really powerful immune systems and the ability to regulate these things. So we apply these in our own lives. It's also a trigger for the anti-aging hormones that every one of us has in our bodies. It's also a trigger for reducing stress and creating more resilience in our lives in time of change. So all of a sudden, knowing that we have access to these cells and that we can harmonize our heart and our brain and our brain together so they can work together, the act of doing this, that single act, opens the door to this vast array of applications, whether it's intuition on demand or, you know, the 1,300 biochemical reactions, positive biochemical reactions, and we can do this. This is what makes us so very powerful. We now know that we are the only species known so far that can trigger these and initiate these relationships on demand. Other forms of life may be able to do it naturally, But we can consciously say in this moment in time, I choose to initiate a state of deep intuition. And that covers everything from precognition, you know, knowing about something before it's going to happen, to being able to communicate with other forms of life, with other mammals. A lot of research is being done with using the heart to communicate with other forms of life. It just goes on and on. So I'm sharing, we're just scratching the tip of the iceberg here. This opens an entire new door of possibilities for these experiences that help us in everyday life that we in the past believed were relegated only to mystics and yogis, you know, living isolated lives in a mountaintop half a world away. We can do this stuff in our living room. And the science now is telling us how it works. And our most cherished and ancient spiritual traditions are telling us how to apply these things in our lives. This is where these two come together in a really beautiful way.
How do we access and utilize these brain cells in the heart? And have you actually engaged in any of these experiments with anyone around that?
Sure. Well, first of all, I'll say the instructions I give, they're very detailed instructions that are in the book Resilience from the Heart. The science has been validated. A lot of the science comes from the Institute of Heart Math and the work they've done over the last 20, I'm sure it's more than 20 years now, that they have perfected in the laboratory under laboratory conditions. My experience with indigenous people is that they have initiated techniques that parallel what the science is now developing. And I think if something is true, I think you're going to see it show up in a lot of different ways. So the fact that science is now catching up, science is only about 300 years old. These indigenous traditions, spiritual traditions, many of them are 5,000 years old. So science is catching up with what our ancestors and what many indigenous traditions have always told us. So since 1986, I've had the opportunity to be with our indigenous family in many different settings, and the monks and nuns and the abbots and the monasteries in Tibet and Nepal and India and through the Andes Mountains of Bolivia and Peru and the monasteries in Egypt and all through the American Desert Southwest and the Yucatan and Mexico and more. And as different as they are from one another, Nicole, what's so fascinating is that there are common themes that flow through every one of these traditions, even though they're spread through different times, different environments, different parts of the world. And when I'm working with the healers and the curanderos and the shamans in these traditions, one of the first things they do before they begin whatever their practice is they begin to access their heart. And that's precisely where the science is leading right now. So the techniques are techniques of focus, of breathing, physically being able to draw the attention from our mind into our heart. This is, I think, probably one of the hardest things for people in the West to do. If I ask someone in a Western environment, in a corporate environment, and if I ask them, if I invite them to shift their awareness from their mind into their heart, they'll say, okay, I'm in my heart now, what's next? And I'll say, well, you know, are you really in your heart? And they say, you know, well, how do you know? And this is where these techniques from the indigenous people really come in handy. One, for example, and I'll just share one of the techniques that they share, is if we can gently touch our heart center, the center of our chest, right there on the sternum, gently touch that in a way that's comfortable for us. Some people use their middle finger and their ring finger, and they just simply touch their right on the bone right there, right over the heart. I'm doing it right now as if you could see me, and here we are on the radio, so we're not. But some people in some traditions in the Middle East, for example, they use an entire open palm, and they place that palm over the center of their chest, over their hearts. And they do the same thing in the Yucatan in southern Mexico. They do the same thing. The point here is that the Buddhists will make the prayer mudra that we're all familiar with, and then they hold that prayer mudra with their thumbs right against the center of their chest. And this is what all of these traditions are doing, is they are physically touching their heart center, and here is the reason why that's important.
You're now tuned in to Nicole Whitney's News for the Soul Highlights. Life-changing spotlights she has shared with leading teachers in the human consciousness field since 1997. Go now to newsforthesoul.com to hear the full shows totally free. That's newsforthesoul.com.
Our awareness, our conscious awareness, will always go to the place in our body where we feel a physical sensation. So when we physically touch our heart center in one of these ways, our awareness automatically goes to the place where that sensation is, and that is one of the techniques that the indigenous people use to move their awareness from their thinking mind into their feeling heart. So I'm just using that as an example. And then the breathing techniques that come after that are now validated. We have equipment, technology that we can hook people up to specialized pieces of software and be able to actually see the effect in their bodies that are occurring from making these connections. So we can talk more about that if you'd like to. I don't know how far you want to go with all of this.
Down the rabbit hole. Yeah, absolutely. This is news to us all. I'll just remind people listening, if you missed it, you mentioned heart math. I talked to Howard Martin, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, and that's in the archives at newsforthesoul.com. And it's funny, you know, when you hear things in threes, this independently, this general topic about the power, true power of the heart has come up three times independently in three different ways for me this week. So I know this is important, and ultimately tying it back into current world events would be awesome. But tell us what's next.
What's next where?
At where you wanted to go.
Oh, well, you just mentioned Howard Martin. Howard is I met Howard because of HeartMath in the early 1990s, and I trained directly with Howard Martin, who is one of the founders of the Institute of HeartMath. Mm-hmm. And I've had the opportunity to tour the world. We have been on stages everywhere, and now I can call him a dear friend as well. So many of the things that I am saying here from my perspective, Howard and the Institute of HeartMath have given me permission as an independent author to share my experience and my perspective, integrating their work at the same time. So where I've had more experience with indigenous people and how indigenous people throughout the different traditions, how they have learned to apply this in our lives, Howard and the research team, the rock solid science behind this stuff, from their institute in Northern California, they come at it from a little bit different perspective when they're training, you know, in a corporate environment or with the U.S. military or something like that. But the bottom line for both is that we're getting people into their hearts. And that means different things to different people, Nicole. We were conditioned, if we were educated in the West, and I'm assuming most of our listeners may not be in North America but have a Western education, we've been taught that the brain is the master organ of the body. And we all know the brain is important, of course. It regulates hormones. It regulates, you know, the temperature in our body and a lot of the rhythms and the cycles and the functions within our bodies. But what we now know is the brain receives the instructions that tell it what to do. Many of those instructions come directly from the heart. Every moment of every day, there is this conversation between our heart and our brain. It's happening right now for everyone listening. There's a conversation. I'll just speak directly to our listeners. Listeners, there's a conversation happening right now between your heart and your brain. Your heart is having a big conversation with your brain through the vagus nerve. It's sending a lot of information through this thick nerve bundle into your brain. Your brain speaks to the heart less. It's not as big of a conversation, and it's coming primarily through the spinal column, down through the back of the brain and then down through the nerves in the spinal cord. So we're always having this conversation. The question is, do we know what we're saying? Do we know what it is that our heart is saying to our brain? And that is the core of these new discoveries and the ancient traditions. And it's by learning to focus in our heart, to breathe specific ways, and to feel very specific kinds of feelings that we set up a dialogue. And the dialogue can be measured electrically. It's a very low frequency, 0.1 hertz, not even one, 0.1 hertz is the frequency that's optimum between the heart and the brain. So when we can focus on our hearts, breathe a little slower than usual, signaling safety to our bodies by breathing a little bit slower than usual, and we can begin feeling positive, what I would call, I don't like to judge feelings, but it's what we call positive feelings, such as gratitude, appreciation, care, compassion. Those are four big ones that the scientists have found work for most people almost 100% of the time. So if you can choose one of those, gratitude, appreciation, care, or compassion, this combination of events, the breathing, the focus, and the feeling, and this is key, when we can feel one or some combination of those four feelings, our body interprets that as this electrical signal from the heart to the brain, and the optimum signal is 0.1 hertz, and when we can establish 0.1 hertz, we can feel the feelings of 0.1 hertz between our heart and our brain, we are said to be in high heart-brain coherence. And that heart-brain coherence is the key to everything that we're talking about here. So in the new book that you mentioned, Resilience from the Heart, first chapter we talk about the new discovery, the cells, 40,000 specialized cells, and then throughout the book what this means and how we apply it in our lives through various exercises. So that's the essence of what that book is all about.
So are feelings the key, the doorway?
You know, it's interesting. They are not exclusively the key. They are an important component that's been discounted in our culture. For most, most people, we have feelings and emotions and experiences, and we've been conditioned to discount them to a large extent until recently. People in their 50s and 60s right now remember when we were taught that, you know, your feelings aren't, you know, they're not really real. I mean, it's just a feeling is what they used to tell us. You know, it was discounted. Now we know that the feeling is a powerful component in these indigenous traditions. And interestingly, Nicole, the very texts of our most cherished spiritual traditions, the Western Bible, for example, and some of the Eastern traditions, when they were edited and there were pieces that were removed or condensed, what was taken out was the information that tells us the power of human emotion. So, for example, in the Christian Bible, the New Testament, the New Testament, and this isn't about religion, this is about instructions. This is about the masters of the past informing their students of the deep relationship that their students had within themselves and with the world around them. And those were based upon spiritual principles. The religions came along later and wrapped the rules and the dogma around those fundamental spiritual principles for control. But before the religions ever existed, those principles were already there, and so that's why I'm mentioning this. So, for example, New Testament, we know at least 43 books were removed in the 4th century by the Emperor Constantine. And what we see today is the reduced, rearranged, condensed version. It's good, but it isn't complete. And we know that because the Nag Hammadi Library, discovered in the mid-1940s, revealed for the first time the original, all the text in their original form. And among those was a book called The Gospel of Thomas. So the Gospel of Thomas contains very specific instructions for the kinds of things that we're talking about that were simply removed from the biblical canon, from the modern Bible in the 4th century, telling us about the power of human emotion and how to use that emotion, for healing in our lives. So that's one example of where we've known this in the past, and then for a number of reasons, that knowledge was taken from one of our most cherished spiritual traditions, and now it's being reintroduced from the language of science. So the power of human emotion is what establishes that 0.1 hertz relationship between the heart and the brain. You can be in your heart and not have the heart-brain relationship, and that is another technique. Sometimes we don't need that full heart-brain relationship. Sometimes we can simply focus in our hearts through touching our heart center, the way that I mentioned, and through breathing techniques that slow our breathing so that we know that we're in a place that's safe. And there are sometimes, for certain kinds of intuition, the technique stops there. That's all you need. And if you want to go deeper and initiate some of the healing techniques and things like that, then you can establish that heart-brain coherence. Also, it has been found to be very effective. I just want to ask, I'm assuming you've had Joe Dispenza on your program. Have you had Joe on recently?
Yes, not recently. I haven't talked to him in a few years, but yes, he's been on as well.
Okay, well, one of the things, and the reason I asked, Dr. Joe Dispenza is a neuroscientist, talks about neuroplasticity and the way the brain can change. Another one of the new discoveries, Nicole, I mean, this stuff, it just goes on and on, because the science is moving so fast right now. But one of the discoveries is the existence of a brain state above the brain states that we've typically seen in our high school and college biology books with the alpha and the beta states. Now we have a gamma state. And the gamma state is a very, very fast brainwave. It is associated with super learning. So, for example, and total recall. So if people have seen movies like, if you've ever seen Jason Bourne, Matt Damon and all of the Jason Bourne movies, where he does these amazing, he could walk into a room, he looks at the room once, he leaves, and he has total recall of everything in the room. Those techniques are actually being taught today, and they're using what we're talking about now, this heart-brain connection, for not only to take in tremendous amounts of information, but to be able to access, to recall the information that we have. Super learning is what it's called. So in a gamma state, that is achieved through this heart-brain connection. We are not only super learning, but it also helps people in who are dealing with depression. It moves them out of the state of depression by being in the gamma state. So there are many benefits, health benefits, even if people aren't into what we would call the spiritual aspect, or they're not into the intuition or subconscious or any of those things. Simply harmonizing the heart and the brain is a really healthy thing to do. And it's something that can be done before we do the other things, the other practices that we have. So if we have a yoga practice, for example, yoga goes much better when our heart-brain is harmonized and in coherence. If we have a martial arts practice, we're much more effective when our heart and brain is in coherence. So what I like to say is everything goes better with coherence.
You're now tuned in to Nicole Whitney's News for the Soul Highlights. Life-changing spotlight she has shared with leading teachers in the human consciousness field since 1997. Go now to newsforthesoul.com to hear the full shows totally free. That's newsforthesoul.com.
So it's not in place of. We become coherent and then go about doing the practices that are important to us. And these techniques, Howard may have mentioned this, they're actually being used in the U.S. military, all four branches of the U.S. military, for our amazing men and women who are serving our country right now in ways that we just don't get to hear about. They're doing much more than working on the battlefield. So much is going on, rebuilding infrastructure and education and medical and all kinds of things. But before they're deployed, many of them are learning about heart-brain harmony so that they are focused when they're in their deployment. And the flip side that I think is really exciting is once your nervous system is wired for battlefield conditions or for survival, when you're deployed halfway around the world in Iraq or Afghanistan or somewhere like that, it doesn't turn off the moment you get on the plane to come home. And the very sad statistics that that we're seeing about U.S. men and women, service men and women coming home, and high rates of suicide, it's very sad to talk about, high rates of divorce, things like that, because they're having problems reintegrating. How do you make that shift from being in the battlefield to walking down the streets of, San Francisco or Chicago or Albuquerque, New Mexico, or, wherever? And these techniques are actually being used to help them reintegrate and reset. The term is to reset their nervous systems. Also being used by first responders, EMTs, police, fire, first responders, right after 9/11, they started using the technique. So I'm just saying this so that our listeners can know this is more than simply a spiritual practice. It is the doorway to the spiritual practices that I've experienced personally through my indigenous experiences or my experiences with indigenous people. But it is also, physiologically, it's a really healthy thing to do, and it opens the door to triggering healthy states within us. As I mentioned, over 1,300 biochemical reactions, positive biochemical reactions, just from doing this one technique. That, again, was a long answer to a short question, but I just wanted people to know that the many applications for something like this.
Mm-hmm. And, intellectually, it makes sense, and based on the conversations we've had over the decades of, the connections with the heart and the power of that in bypassing the straight conscious mind, it all makes sense, right? So how do we apply this, or can we apply this, to manifesting a more positive outlook path for the collective in the world right now?
Well, this is it's a really good question, Nicole, and this is another facet of the studies that are being done, pioneered by the Institute of HeartMath. And as a former geologist, I'm not a practicing geologist now, but I am an earth scientist. So I find this, what I'm about to share, especially fascinating. We've all heard of the magnetic field of the earth, and the magnetic field, a lot of people don't know, is that it influences every form of life. I mean, every blade of grass, every dog, every cat, every hamster, every goldfish, every CEO of every corporation, every leader of every nation, there is no them and us when it comes to the magnetic field of the earth. There is only a we. We are all deeply influenced by this field. And here's the reason that I'm saying this and why it's important. is because the science is showing very clearly that when the magnetic field of the Earth is strong, it influences us in a positive way. We become less aggressive, more cooperative, more willing to work together, better listeners. And when the magnetic fields are weak, just the opposite happens. We become more aggressive, less willing to work together. And unfortunately, we discovered this through 9/11. 9/11 was the first time that scientists discovered how deep our relationship to the Earth really goes. Now, maybe to our listeners, we say, you know, this is, you know, no big news to us. We've always known this. That's to the listeners of this program. But scientists have been trained to think of humans as separate from one another, separate from the Earth. And they've been trained to believe that we have very little influence over our own bodies and over what happens in the world. And 9/11 taught scientists that that's not true, and here is what happened. The magnetic fields that I just described, they're so important that we have satellites every 30 minutes, or maybe even more frequently, but every 30 minutes they send data back to the Earth to tell scientists how strong those fields are and what's happening. They fluctuate on a daily basis. There are rhythms. They ebb and they flow. It looks like a big sine wave. Every 24 hours, the magnetic fields of the Earth ebb and they flow, and they ebb and they flow. Scientists knew that. But what happened was there was one day when the magnetic data from the Earth, there was this huge spike. It was higher than what they would traditionally see. And they weren't used to seeing that. And they said, well, you know, what on Earth? I mean, literally, what on Earth is happening to make these magnetic fields so strong? And they looked at the date where that spike occurred, and it was 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, September 11th, 2001. It was 15 minutes after the first planes hit the first tower of the World Trade Center. So the scientists believe it took about 15 minutes for those horrific images that we all remember, those of us that were living then. They believe it took about 15 minutes for those images to circulate the globe and for people to respond emotionally to what they were seeing. And for most people, that response, it was a heart-based response. Now, they were different. Some of it was fear. Some of it was sadness. Some of it was shock. But everyone, it was a heart-based experience. The strongest magnetic field generated in the human body is generated by the human heart. And some people are surprised by that because they think it's the brain. The brain has a magnetic and electrical field, but it's weak compared to the human heart. The heart has the strongest electrical and the strongest magnetic field in the human body. So 9/11, what happened was hundreds of millions of people simultaneously were witnessing the horrors of New York City in 9/11, and hundreds of millions of hearts were generating increased magnetic response to what they were seeing that actually influenced the magnetic fields of planet Earth. And this is what was showing up on the satellite data. We spiked the magnetic field of our planet in response to what we saw, and here's why that's important. If you and your listeners can remember it, at least for a few days after 9/11, we were so close as a global family. I mean, not only in America, I was in Australia when the whole thing happened. I couldn't even come home for a few days. So I know that it wasn't only in America, but we were close as a family. People in big cities, they looked at each other in the eyes, and they spoke to one another, and there were hugs that were happening. And there was this sense of unity. And scientists attribute that to the high magnetic fields of the planet that resulted from our seeing what had happened. So the question became immediately, can we create that kind of an experience without the tragedy? Can we consciously raise that magnetic field of the planet without having a tragedy that we react to? Can we do it because we choose to? And the answer is yes. And this became the foundation of a project that is spearheaded by the Institute of Heart Math and for Transparency. I want our listeners to know I'm on the steering committee and a spokesperson for this project that is called the GCI, the Global Coherence Initiative. So the personal coherence we just talked about, personal coherence is good for us individually. Global coherence is good for the planet. And what has happened, I'll just make a long story very brief because I know we're coming up on the end of our hour here. Satellites to detect these fields are very expensive. So the scientists, the Institute of Heart Math, worked on ground-based sensors and created a network of these sensors in different nations that all feed back to one computer in Northern California, and they measure the planet's response and our interaction with the planet. They measure these magnetic fields every day. And if people want to see these, you can actually see them real time. You can see them about, I think they post them usually at midnight after the data has been analyzed every day, at www.heartmath.org, and then go to GCI, Global Coherence Initiative. Doesn't cost you anything. You can see the live data. You can see the science. You can read about the sensors. So we now have a way, a feedback mechanism, so we can see what's happening with the fields of the Earth. That's part one. Part two is training people to create this heart-brain coherence so that throughout every day across this planet, there are people that are literally feeding the field in a positive way. So we're all feeding it every day. We're all having feelings. The question is, what are we feeding the field every day? And it's by learning these various techniques of heart-brain coherence that we're actually contributing not only to our own health, but contributing to the field that influences our cooperation or lack of cooperation on the planet. So it is, there are two things happening here. We've got personal and we've got global healing that is occurring from embracing this relationship that was known by our ancestors in ancient traditions and is now being validated and reconfirmed and expanded through the best science of the modern world. And it all happens within the context of a world that we're living a time of extremes. The world is changing faster than we've been prepared to accept, and for many of us, we're just not used to that kind of change. So I think when I said I trust in the process, it's only now that the science is giving us the tools to tune our bodies and harmonize to the rate of change that we're seeing in the world while the demand for that change is emerging. And I think it's perfect symmetry, perfect timing. I don't understand everything that's happening. I don't claim to, but I do trust in the process and as I see it unfolding.
Wow, that's exciting. Global coherence sounds very intriguing. When next time we talk, we'll have to get more into that. I'm curious as if you know if there was any kind of major thing tracked on November 8th, 2016.
If there were any major, the signal broke up a little bit, and I couldn't hear what you said, Nicole.
Sorry, major energy shift tracked on November 8, 2016.
You know, it was interesting. I went back. It was not what people would have expected. I went back, and I looked at the magnetic fields. You're talking about the elections, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I went back, and I looked. Well, first I compared. I went back to Obama's first election, the very first time he was elected. And what the data showed is that there was a lot of excitement in the fields leading up to his inauguration. And on inauguration day, not so much the election, but on inauguration day, the field became very quiet. It was the global energetic field became very quiet. Scientists are reluctant to say one thing causes another. So what they will say is that something correlates with another. And there's a high correlation between a calm that flowed across the planet, at least in those magnetic fields, and when the inauguration happened, and it lasted for a few days. We didn't see that kind of change, but we also didn't see a lot of, they thought there, the scientists and many casual observers thought there might be some kind of, anxiety showing up in the field. And that didn't really show up either, at least initially. It showed up a few days, I think it was 3 or 4 days later, there started to be a lot of activity in the field. And if you go in on this website, the bright areas that you see on those 24-hour charts, that is where there's a high level of activity. And when you see the dark blues and we don't see much happening there, that is those are the quieter areas. So there was I think people were surprised at what happened during the election and inauguration. And I think maybe the field, this is my personal opinion, this isn't HeartMath saying this, my personal feeling is I think the world was surprised and was kind of, I think the magnetic fields are reflecting us kind of letting it sink in what has just happened. And it took a few days to do that. And then about 3 days later, we started seeing a lot of, really a lot of activity. And that's, I think, when people figured out what just happened and they said, okay, now what? What's next?
So, that makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, that's a very intriguing project. Wow, I was not aware of that, and now I'm on the live data, so I'm going to be on there for several hours. That's fun. Thanks for letting
us
know about
that. You were able to bring up the site while we're talking?
Yes. I went into Global Coherent under research and then live data. So you can see
the live data. What's important here is this project, and I tell you, everyone is fascinated by this, U.S. military, mainstream scientists. We have never had this depth of understanding between the human body and the magnetic fields of the Earth as individuals and the collective response and our collective relationship to this field. And it goes back, it harkens back to this idea that we are part of the world rather than separate from. We are part of a living system, and we influence this system consciously or subconsciously, whether we know it or not. We're influencing it. And now we have the ability to consciously come together as a global community. And through doing something that's good for us individually, collectively, it's good for our communities and it's good for nations. And I can't think of a better time to have that ability and to breathe life into that ability. And maybe not a better way to end our program, because it looks like it's almost the top of the hour for you. So
we are there indeed. I really appreciate you, your work, your long years of dedication to bringing this information forward, and I hope you'll join me when your next book comes out by October to discuss that as well.
I would love to. All I need is an invitation, so I think I just heard one.
You did.
Yeah, Nicole, right, thank you. Thank you so much for the work you're doing, and everyone listening, I just want to thank you all for all you're doing just to be the best person you can be and to create the best world possible. I'm an optimist. I've never been more optimistic about our world, and I'm also a realist. We have a lot of work to do to bring what we know in our hearts to fruition in our lives. And I just want to say one thing about work. The prophet Khalil Gibran, the poet and the prophet and the author in the 20th century, in his book that was titled The Prophet, he wrote about work. And what he said very clearly, and I read this when I was 10 years old, and it's been with me ever since, he said, work is our love made visible. Work is love made visible. And it's going to take a lot of work to change the way we think and live. That's our love made visible. And I think we're worth it, and I think our world is worth it. So that's what I'd like to leave our listeners with today, Nicole.
Perfect. Resilience from the Heart, Greg Radin's latest book. We'll talk to him again soon. And, Greg, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much. I look forward to the next time. Take care.
I'm looking forward to it already. Greg Radin can be found online and linked up at newsforthesoul.com. This will be in the archives and re-aired on our California stations this week, and we'll go out from there. We are back with more right after this.
You're now tuned in to Nicole Whitney's News for the Soul highlights, life-changing spotlights she has shared with leading teachers in the human consciousness field since 1997. Go now to newsforthesoul.com to hear the full shows totally free. That's newsforthesoul.com.
And we love News for the Soul!
I'm feeling enormous energy around this show. Just enormous, enormous. I really have to hand it to you, Nicole. You've created sort of a niche of amazing, amazing connections. It's just like the angels and the devatas that are like attracted to News for the Soul is amazing. Like, this is what's getting, it's some angel telling somebody, okay, listen, get on this show, listen to this program, even not my program, whatever program you've got on. It's really amazing.
It's hard to believe it's 17 years since there in Vancouver. And you were sitting there in class, and you were using remote viewing, and I think I said to you that you were going to be a radio talk show host or something along those lines. It wasn't really a prediction. It was just a kind of a sense of who you were and what you were doing and the direction you were going. And wow, voila, and there you were.
And still going.
But it's amazing. Look at what you've done with it. I just wanted to say I'm very proud of you for what you've accomplished, for just the format, to the assemblage of wonderful people, great minds, and people who are working to serve humanity and do the things that they do. I've been looking through your list of callers and interviewees, and you just do a tremendous job. I'm so proud of you. I really am. And I'm proud of all the people that support you and follow you and do what they do, and just keep doing that for this wonderful woman. It's so important, because there are not a lot of really high-quality message portals that are out there where messengers get to come in and say what they want to say in this format. So it's because of your support of her that she's able to continue doing that. So please step that up and continue doing it. And I just want to do it more. I mean, I feel good being here and being with you. I always do when I'm talking with you. So I think we just need to keep doing this more.
And we love News for the Soul!
Hello, everybody. This is Damian Brinkley. Welcome to the hearts and minds of Enfoldment. This is News for the Soul.
Hello, this is Satyan Raja, and you're listening to News for the Soul. Be open in your mind, your body, your being. Allow yourself to drench in this awesome information to evolve you to your next place.
Hey, this is Dave Morehouse, and you're listening to News for the Soul.
Yeah, man. We all love to hear the good news, so we all should rush to hear the good news. But we can just find the good news. NSTS, NSTS. News for the soul at the very best. NSTS, NSTS. News for the soul at the very best. NSTS, NSTS. News for the soul at the very best. Yeah, man, just log on to www.newsforthesoul.com. News for the soul.com. Can you miss? We are a life-changing talk radio. We give you good news to keep you on the go. And you can also share the good news, you know. And that's the way we keep in the flow. Wah! We only focus on the positive things, yeah. We only focus on the positive things, yeah. We not go put none of the negative in there. We not go put none of the negative in there. NFTN, NFTN. News for the soul at the very best. NFTN, NFTN. News for the soul at the very best. Log on to www.newsforthesoul.com. Every time. Come here, good news. Share the good news. And we all feeling good for the good news. We are a life-changing talk radio. We give you good news to keep you on the go. And you can also share the good news, you know. And that's the way we keep in the flow. Wah! We only focus on the positive things, yeah. We only focus on the positive things, yeah. We not go put none of the negative in there. We not go put none of the negative in there. NFTN, NFTN. News for the soul at the very best. NFTN, NFTN. News for the soul at the very best. Log on to www.newsforthesoul.com. Every time. Come here, good news. Share the good news. And we all feeling good for the good news.
You are listening to the News for the Soul Radio Network.
And we're back, and it's time to go live again. I'm Nicole Marie Whitney, News for the Soul Radio, life-changing talk radio. From the uplifting to the unexplained, and over the many years that we've been around, we have talked to one very special scientist and author with a real gift in bridging science and spirit. Dr. Bruce Lipton is with me here for the next hour, here today on News for the Soul. And I actually can't remember the last time we talked to him live, but he's the author of Biology of Belief. And it, believe it or not, is the 10th anniversary of Biology of Belief. So we're going to be talking about that. In case you don't know, he is a stem cell biologist, best-selling author, recipient of the 2009 GOI Peace Award, and he's been a guest speaker on hundreds of TV and radio shows, including ours over the years. And like I said, bridging science and spirit, there's great power in that one place, and that's where we begin. Dr. Bruce Lipton, welcome back to News for the Soul.
Thank you so very much. I'm so happy to be back on the show, and I'm so happy to be able to talk to the wonderful audience, because they're my cultural creatives, the ones that are helping create a new civilization, and I so appreciate them.
You know, so much has happened in that field since you and I first ever spoke, and when you began on your path. It's amazing now to see the changes coming to pass that we just talked about seeing before.
Well, it for me, it's very exciting because it was an opportunity to see something, and then I had to be patient enough to wait long enough for the public to get it. But it's like, for me, it was so exciting to see a whole different understanding of the planet and the world we live in, and the nature of spirituality, which as a scientist, I never entertained that idea, really. And through the study of the cells, it was like, oh, my gosh, we're not in here. We're broadcast. And it's like, wow. So that was like an instant transformation from non-spiritual to spiritual in about a minute of like, oh, my God, that's how it works. Oh, God, I'm not in here. But
so,
yes, go ahead, darling.
What's happening? Why 10th anniversary? What's changed? Where do you want to start with this today?
Well, basically, the new edition of the book for me is kind of fun because I was asked when I was talking with Hay House, and it was like, well, it was coming up 10 years, and I thought this would be a good time to revise and update, I thought. And so they said, hey, okay, why don't we do that? Take a look at it. And for me, what was the really most exciting part, I hadn't read the book for 10 years, I guess, anyway, and I sat down and read the book, and I got to the end of it, and I said, wow, I don't have to change a word of this book. It's exactly right from the 10 years of science. And I said, but a lot has happened in the last 10 years of new stuff that is relevant to our lives. I thought, no, I really wanted to include some what has happened in 10 years. So there's an additional 40 or more pages of current things, including wonderful discussion about something called telomeres, which I presume was talked about on your show at some time, right? Telomeres? Does that make any sense?
No.
Oh, my goodness. That's
goodness.
The fountain of youth. There is an absolute fountain of youth, and that's part of the book, and then there's a lot more on the nature of how we malign the concept of cholesterol as being something bad when that's not true at all, that we blame this thing, and then we try to regulate cholesterol, which is like, oh, my God, the machine is a very complicated body inside. It's a machine, and when you start throwing drugs in there, it's sort of like throwing monkey wrenches into the machine sometimes. So the statin drugs, which people are on, is like, oh, my God, it's completely wrong. So interesting ideas about new ways of looking at life, and it comes down to also the main thing about stress. Because we look at illness and disease, and we say, oh, well, there's genetics behind it, and it comes out, well, less than 1% of disease is genetically based. And that should stop people and say, well, wait a minute, then if less than 1% comes from genetics and biology, then where does the disease come from? And it turns out lifestyle and stress. And all of a sudden that becomes really important because if we blame genes, then people just say, oh, it had nothing to do with me. It's my heredity. You know, it's like, oh, my God, my life was predetermined by those genes. And that makes people feel like they're victims. Why? Well, I didn't pick the genes, and I can't change them, and apparently you're controlling my life. And then I say, yeah, but when we understand the whole new biology is coming together, it reveals, no, we're not victims. We're actually controlling our lives, but we had no understanding of how the invisible operation of the control was going on. So we had no awareness that we were involved with every aspect of our life. And now the new biology says, oh, my goodness, we are the masters. We are the ones that control our behavior and our genetics and all aspects of our lives. But we just didn't have the understanding or programming to know while we have that opportunity, we haven't been doing it. We've been running by programs. So this awakening is what? Going from the idea of victim of your life to the understanding that we are masters, that we can control this biology on the inside and profoundly influence every life aspect on the outside when we start to understand the new biology.
So maybe a quick recap on your original aha for the many that are still unfamiliar with your story and in many countries listening right now.
Yeah, I think, well, that's really important because this is the foundation of today. It has become a revolution in planetary awareness that changes the things we were just talking about, going from victim to master. When I was back, let's say, in 1970, and being involved with teaching in a medical school, I was teaching medical students the belief that genes control life, the idea that most people still hold anyway. I was teaching it back then. And at the same time, I was cloning stem cells, and this was like 40-some years ago. And what I found in the stem cell culture was, I would put one cell in a petri dish, one stem cell. That's an embryonic-like cell, multipotential. And I'd put one stem cell in a petri dish by itself, and it would divide every 10 hours. And after a week, you'd have about 50,000 cells because it keeps doubling and doubling. And I said, but what's interesting, there are 50,000 genetically identical cells. The experiment I did was split the cells up into three different petri dishes and change the environment a little bit in each dish. And they say, well, what's the environment? I say, well, we grow cells in culture medium, a fluid. And I go, well, why? Well, because that's the natural state inside the body. They're inside a fluid system. When you cut yourself open, the fluids leak out. So basically, cells grow in a fluid environment. And I say, well, what is the composition, or, you know, how do you make up an environment for cells? And I go, you identify the blood components from the organism where you get the cells from. So in other words, if I grow mouse cells, I make culture medium based on the blood components found in mouse blood. And when I grow human cells, I try to make culture medium, which has the same composition as human blood. So it's like they're at home. So I say, okay, what did I do? I have genetically identical cells, three dishes, but I changed the composition of the culture medium a little bit in each of the three dishes. So I have genetically identical cells, but a different environment in each dish. And the result was, in one dish, the cells form muscle. In the second dish, the cells form bone. And in the third dish, the cells form fat cells. Well, there's a very profound point here. It's like, well, who or what controlled the fate of the cells? Point. They were all genetically identical, so it wasn't built into the genes where this program unfolded from. They all had the same genes. It turned out it was the environment. And the relevance about that is, here I am in the classroom teaching students genes are making decisions. Genes turn on and off. Genes control life. And then I find out in my research, it's like, that's not true at all. It was like, whoa. Basically, that was some pioneering work. Today's field of science that is really focusing on what I was seeing 40 years ago is called epigenetics. And you say, well, it sounds like genetics. I go, well, here's the difference. When I was teaching in medical school, I was teaching what was called genetic control, simply control by genes. I say, but today the science is not called genetics, it's called epigenetics. And I say, well, what's the epi? I say, oh, epi means above. So I say, oh, then when I talk about today, epigenetic control, I'm saying control above the genes. This is the whole remarkable evolution. We were thinking genes turn on and off. That's a total false statement. Genes are blueprints. They have no more activity than a blueprint in an architect's office. They're just patterns. But the idea about it is something selects the patterns and selects the programming above the genes. And that's what we're beginning to find out. It's the environment that is adjusting the biology so that whatever's going on in the environment influences your biology. So you walk outside and it's warm out and the skin feels warm. The biology adjusts itself now to cool down the body. Oh, you walk outside when it's cold out. Oh, when you feel the environment of cold, the body adjusts itself to make itself warm. So the body is adjusting itself to the environment. And I say, well, why is that relevant? And I go, well, some environments are very healthy and some environments are not very healthy. And when we get sick, we have a tendency to say, oh, the genes and the biology are the problem. Now we know that over 90% of illness is not due to the genes at all. Less than 1% of illness is due to genes. And so where's the illness coming from? And it says the environment, and here's the catch, Nicole. It's not just environment, but our perception of the environment. And I say this becomes very important because The environment, hot, cold outside, directly affects the temperature of the body straight on one to the other. But if there's something going on in your life and you have a vision of it, you have a perception, oh, is this good or is this bad? Is this threatening or is this loving? That's a perception at that moment. And I say, why is it relevant? Because whatever you're seeing is turned into chemistry that goes into the blood, and the blood is the culture medium that controls the genetics and the behavior. So here's the simplest understanding, and it's so profound. It works like this, is that the chemical composition of the blood controls the fate and genetics of the cell. And then I say the brain is the thing that creates the chemistry in the blood. And then I say, yeah, but what chemical should the brain put into the blood? And I say, well, whatever picture is in the mind. And when we were younger, we probably played with something called paint by numbers, where you get a picture with outlines and numbers in it, and you get a set of paints with numbers on each different color, and then you put the colors into the spaces, and then lo and behold, you create this masterpiece of art. And I say, you know what's interesting, and this is how simple life is. I love how simple it becomes, and it's like this. The mind, brain, and blood relationship is paint by numbers in reverse, meaning you first start with a picture in your mind, and then the brain breaks the picture down into numbers, but instead of paints, the numbers represent neurohormones and growth factors and regulators and immune system controls and all these things. So in other words, your mind sees a picture, your brain breaks it down into a complement to that picture in regard to nerve secretions. And that then goes into the body and controls the behavior. So what's the point? Your biology is a reflection of what you see going on in the world. And if you change how you see the world, you change your biology and you change your genetics. A wonderful insight, which is mentioned in the book, is Dean Ornish, an internist from San Francisco, has done a lot of wonderful work. He took his prostate cancer patients, split them into two groups. He read the genetic readout of both groups of patients at the start. One group got the regular medical treatment, whatever the drugs and stuff that was, and the other group got no drugs or anything. What they got was lifestyle changes. They learned how to eat a better diet. They learned how to reduce stress. They learned how to meditate. And 90 days after the start of the experiment, they then read the genes of both groups, and the drug gene people, the genes stayed exactly the same as they were, but in the group that did lifestyle change, 500 genes, many of them directly associated with the prostate cancer, changed their function in that 90-day period of what? Just changing lifestyle. So there's the beautiful part about all of this, Nicole, is that we're transitioning in a world where we have been taught to believe we are victims, victims of our heredity, and that when you're a victim, you give up responsibility because you have no control anyway, and also then you give up your savings to anybody who says they're going to help you with your problem, and then I say, and what's happening today? And it turns around, no. If we understand how the mechanism works now, it's how our thoughts and our beliefs and our mind are translated by the biology into the chemistry of our blood, which is then controlling behavior and genetics. And if we know that, just as we just said, then it basically says this, what if you change your behavior? And I go, well, then you change your biology at that point. And all of a sudden it says, oh my goodness, then we are masters of our biology. We're not victims of anything. The only thing we're victims of is the belief that we're victims, and that's wrong. So this is an exciting time, a revolution on the planet, especially when you consider the healthcare crisis, the money, the amount of money that we're spending to bring people to health through a model that says, oh, it's just a broken genes and broken body, and give them some chemistry and they'll come back. And then find out it had nothing to do with that, except for 1%, but it had to do with our lifestyle, our beliefs, our spirituality, our attitudes about life, love, diet, and exercise. There you go. And those are things we can control. And if you understand we can control it, then it says, oh, well, then you don't have to be unhealthy if you don't want to be. because we can change our environment and we can change our perceptions.
Which is huge, of course, why you're you and what you're doing. The perceptions, are they as easy to change as you're suggesting?
Yes, when you have knowledge of how to change them. If you don't have an understanding, then it's one of the more difficult processes in our lives because there's a mechanism, and we have to understand. Let me just give you the idea of how powerful a perception is, because it's in some stage shows with hypnosis, they hypnotize an individual, and they tell that person, we're going to touch you with a burning cigarette on your arm. And under that state of hypnosis, that individual under hypnosis perceives that's what happened, but the person only touched them with their finger, just, you know, touched their arm with their finger. And within a minute or two, a blister begins to form. And it's like, didn't just form anywhere, formed exactly where the person got touched. And you stop for a second and say, how can you accommodate that? How does you make any sense out of that? Because the logic thing, obviously the skin did not get burned at all. And you say, well, but the blister formed exactly where you touched it. And the answer was this. The perception of the mind saw a burn, and the mind controlled the biology to manifest the blister. And all of a sudden you say, oh, my God, look, I can manifest a blister, and it never really occurred. And I go, and this is why we have to really understand why our perceptions are so important, because if they're negative perceptions, without our even understanding it, we are translating those into a negative status of our health. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, my God, to get the health back, they say, well, we'll go to the doctor, we'll get some drugs. I go, no, you want the health back is take away the negative image, take away that perception. Very simply, you know, I'm sorry I keep talking so much, Nicole, but I'm trying to get this out, how simple this is. When I was learning how to grow cells in tissue culture, one of the first things I learned was this, was that after I put the cells into the culture, the procedure of getting them and then putting them into culture, I put the dishes in the incubator overnight and come back and look at them in the morning. And my major advisor at the time in teaching me how to do this said, when you come back in the morning, if the cells don't look good, that means, you know, they're not healthy looking and they don't look right, don't blame the cells. First, look at the conditions of the culture medium. And why that was relevant was at some point was I didn't even know it, but years later that's what the epigenetic science ultimately came to say, was that it's the environment that is manifesting that. So I take a dish of healthy cells, put it in a less than optimum environment, and the cells start to get sick and die. And then if there was a cell doctor, he'd say, oh, yeah, Bruce, your cells are sick. Well, yeah, we should get a prescription and give them some drugs. And then I go, no, all you have to do is take the cells from the bad environment, move them into the good environment, and they will instantly get healthy again. The point, the cells become a complement to the...
Oops. That was weird.
Yeah.
I got cut off. I'm back. Well, it sounds so simple.
We didn't talk about changing, but that's how simple it works. I mean, that's the amazing part. It's like... That we can imagine all kinds of complexities why my life turned out this way. And if you leave out this first understanding is that your perceptions are creating this unfolding, then we're really lost because we're trying to figure out how the outside did that to me when we had responsibility at some point. Hello?
You sort of cut out for a minute. We're having
intermittent
glitches. So just the last 10 seconds cut out.
Okay, you can edit that?
Well, no, we're live.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you got to go with the flow, you know. So.
That's right.
It's important for us to recognize that if we own that we have responsibility, then it means we own that we can do something about it. And as you brought up, changing the perceptions, and as you also brought up, it seems to be very hard because so many people have difficulty in changing it. You know, you read all the self-help books, you go to the videos and watch the lectures, you do all these things, and no matter how much learning you get about how it should be, it hardly changes. And after, oh my God, it changes hard. Well, to break it down, let's make it understanding about this. The mind, which is controlling the system, is actually comprised of two independent parts that are connected together. One is called the subconscious mind, and that mind is the equivalent of a record playback device, like a CD recorder. You record something, you push play, and it plays it back. Every time you do it, it plays it back, same thing over and over again. So the subconscious mind is like the habit mind. The latest evolution of the brain is right behind your forehead, a lobe of brain tissue called the prefrontal cortex, and associated with that was the development of the conscious mind. I said, well, what's the difference? Well, as I said, the subconscious mind is a habit mind. It learns behavior, stimulus, response, and that's how it, you know, its life is managed. But when you get to the conscious mind, something's totally different, and the idea is that it can think, number one. It's not just stimulus, response, it can think. But, and number two, it can see into the future or look into the past. It can review the past or it can look into the future. And I say, well, why is this relevant? Because the conscious mind, here's the difference. The conscious mind is a creative mind. Because I can say, well, what do you want to do on Monday? And it's not Monday yet. You obviously are creating something for Monday, so it's creative. And I go, yes, and here's the interesting part about it. It's the mind that's also connected to you as a personal identity, the connection to your spirituality, your source, who you are, is playing through this mind. So it's you and it's creative. So I say, oh, cool. So I say the conscious mind has your wishes and desires in it. And so if I say, what do you want out of your life? You're looking, say, in the future I want X. You're creating an idea. So wishes, desires, aspirations, conscious mind, habits, subconscious mind. Okay, and then I say, okay, here's the difference. The subconscious mind learns in a different way than the conscious mind. The conscious mind, because it's creative, can learn from, as we mentioned, reading a book, going to a lecture, watching a video, just going, aha, and the conscious mind can learn something. I go, well, this is not the same as the subconscious. I go, no, subconscious is a habit mind. And that means this. When you put in a habit, you don't want it to change, especially if it's an important habit, like walking, for example. If you learned how to walk, you don't want that to change. So the habit mind is resistant to change, firstly, okay? And it doesn't learn in the same way. It's not creative. It has to learn in a different way. So here's the issue. We now recognize that the subconscious mind in the first 7 years of life is downloading life experiences straight into the subconscious. In other words, the conscious mind of a child is not really fully engaged until around age 7, when the brain develops another higher level of function. Below age 7, the brain activity of the child is mainly in a wavelength called theta, which is below consciousness. It's imagination, in fact, and that's why kids, especially, you know, 2 to 7, can mix the real world and the imaginary world, because their brain operating at theta is that zone, but that zone is also hypnosis. And you say, why should the brain be in hypnosis? And the answer is simply this. There's so much you can program with genes. And culture, you can't program with genes. It changes all the time, so there's no genes for how to behave. And yet, when you're born into a family, the first thing you've got to learn is how to be a functional member of the family and then a functional member of the community. And I say, well, how many rules is that? And all of a sudden you say, well, it's thousands of rules. I go, okay, teach a two-year-old. Here, sit down. I got to teach you a few thousand rules here about how to be a functional member of the family. It's like, well, that's not going to work. But it works for this reason. Nature designed the brain to be in a record mode for 7 years. Recording what? The behavior of the mother, the father, the family, the community. Why? It's observing behavior and learning how the interactions occur, how a parent talks to a child is different than how they talk to each other, which is different than how they talk to the neighbor, which is even different than how they talk to a policeman. It's like, wow, the child learns all these, but doesn't learn them by reading or anything. It learns them by just recording, 7 years of recording. And that's why the first 7 years is download. Then consciousness begins, and then consciousness can use the data to make a life from it, but first you have to put the data in. So I say, well, the relevance then is the data that went into the subconscious mind in the first 7 years, A, is other people's behavior, because you were recording other people. So that's A. B, you weren't conscious of the recording because your conscious brain wasn't working anyway at that point. So you didn't see this download occurring, okay? So it wasn't filtered. It was just whatever you saw was the download. And most importantly, it was a period where the brain was in theta, which is called hypnosis, okay? After 7, the conscious brain kicks in. The subconscious is no longer working on hypnosis at this point, okay? Now it's working on life experiences of live, what you're doing, okay? It changes the direction a bit. But the relevance is this. If the subconscious learned in the first 7 years through a process called hypnosis, but after 7 years, it learns in a different way. And what it learns by is repetition, habit. That's what's called the habit mind. So if you want to change a program after you're age 7, you have to make a habit, like an exercise, and you got to repeat that habit, just like learning how to drive a car or learning how to walk. You had to learn. You had to do it every day, repeat it till you get it down. Or the ABCs. How many times did you start A and never could finish until you learned the next couple of letters, and then you kept progress until you could get to Z, and now guess what? Once you learned it, you don't have to do it again. So the nature of repetition is after 7, okay? So I say, well, you want to change the subconscious mind. How do most people try to do it? First big mistake is they attempt to talk to themselves. It's like, oh, you're talking to yourself. Well, Bruce, don't eat that donut. You know, it's really bad. It's really, you know, don't do that. So I'm talking to myself. Don't eat my donut there. And then 10 minutes later, I'm standing there with a donut in my hand going, oh, you know, you didn't listen to me. What's going on here? You know, what the heck are you doing with a donut? And then I go, here's the point. The subconscious mind is a recording device that is recording these habits. It's a machine. There's nobody in there. Point. If you're talking to yourself, then presumably somebody's listening to you. You say, well, who's listening? You say, well, the subconscious is listening. I go, no. You see, subconscious is a machine. There's nobody in there. So if you want to change a recording on a disc, you can put the disc into the machine, and you can talk to the machine all you want. It's never going to change anything. And that's the most frustrating thing, because we can see what we want to change. We know what we want to change. We tell ourselves, and yet it doesn't work. And I say, why? Subconscious mind doesn't learn that way. It learns A, through hypnosis, or B, through repetition. And I'm going to add a third one right now because it's really important. There's a whole new field, and this is the exciting one, called energy psychology. And energy psychology is are modalities of changing subconscious programs that rely on super learning processes. And you say, super learning? I go, yeah. Maybe you've seen somebody read a book by moving their finger down the page. As fast as they move the finger down, they read every word on the page, and they flip through a book, and they can read a book in minutes. That's an expression of super learning. I say, what's the point? I say, with some of these modalities, you can change a belief you had your whole life in about 10 or 15 minutes. And he's like, wow, this is pretty exciting. I go, yeah, we've had problems changing beliefs from before. For what reason? Way? Because we thought that the conscious mind, subconscious mind were one and the same. So if the conscious mind became aware of something, of course the subconscious mind should have followed along. Okay, first mistake. No, they're two separate minds. Second, we believe that, well, one mind can talk to the other mind. I go, okay, false. Because you, the talker, in the conscious mind, is trying to talk to the subconscious when it's just a machine. Nobody's in there. So that's why the failure of that, okay? And then what we have to recognize is in the subconscious mind learns in different ways. It, as I said, hypnosis.